Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond headlines with sharp insight and expert analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping the future. So live or on demand, we'll bring you the stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program, Ramaphosa faces Trump in a high-stakes Oval Office test. Budget version 3.0 still leaves a 75 billion rand gap to fill. Digital innovation reshaping the future of electricity in South Africa, and restorative farming takes center stage on this World Biodiversity Day. It's Thursday, the 22nd of May. Now, in what could prove to be one of the more diplomatically delicate engagements of the year, President Ramaphosa has met face-to-face with Donald Trump in Washington. The aim of this meeting, according to my guest, was threefold: to avoid a so-called Zelensky moment of being politically steamrolled, also for South Africa to stand its ground on critical issues like land reform and race relations, and crucially push back diplomatically but firmly against what many see as outright lies from Donald Trump, particularly his claims of a white genocide in South Africa. There's no doubt it was a high wire act of resolve and reset, with Ramaphosa attempting to manage both the bilateral fallout and domestic political theatre playing out at home. Let's pull all of that together. I'm in conversation with Dr. T.K. Puer, who's a senior lecturer at the Wits School of Governance. T.K., a very warm welcome. So 24 hours on, was this a diplomatic success or a missed opportunity?
No, afternoon. Look, I think it falls in a bit of both, in the sense that it wasn't a total disaster, which is, I think, the key thing people didn't want. But it also did give maybe South Africans and the international community a bit of insight into finally trying to clear, well, as much as you can, clear up the, how do I put it, the fracas President Trump has created around narratives that do not exist. So I'd probably put it as it was something bearable, but at times it was like, oh my word, where's this going?
These constant assertions from President Trump about the white genocide in South Africa, and widely rejected and disputed, but you'll have to agree with me that claims like this do have an impact on our international image and even internal social cohesion. It is a very disturbing message.
Yes, it's actually quite, it's a national security issue, because once you get this label from a country which is the size of America, look, I think the audience would know, Americans and most people, South Africa is but one of many countries on the continent, if not the world. So if you don't have the ability to clear it up, it creates its own problems. But I think that's why yesterday was so important. While I don't think the president fully rammed home the issue, but on the key issues in terms of what President Trump sounded like afterwards, because I mean, the key takeaway for me on the genocide issue is even he said, you know what, I'm not yet also sold on whether it is or it isn't. So if I was the South African government, the key thing is spin that word around the world, because like you're saying, international investors have to know that, listen, this is probably one of President Trump's side projects. It's not something to be taken that seriously. But more importantly, it's an issue of how then do we reform our own internal issues, such that the issues that were mentioned, which are correct, that South Africa's got a high crime rate, those types of issues are addressed very quickly.
So we started this messaging at the apex in the Oval Office, and in that room were billionaires and golfers. Do you think in any way we might have started to move the needle then?
I think the key two people for me in that room that moved the needle outside of President Ramaphosa is Mr. Johann Rupert. He basically and firmly kind of shut down a lot of the misconceptions which exist around South Africa, and also the chairperson of the COSATU, Ms. Lodzi, who really almost just put into perspective to say, listen, this is a whole of problem of South Africa, Mr. Trump, that type of issue. So I think we did kind of move the needle, especially when Mr. Rupert, look, firmly, and also I think with the invite of President Ramaphosa, kind of really put things back into, I can say, put the trains back on the track. But the key issue is how do you follow this up? Because the one thing we do know about President Trump is yesterday he might have said Yeah, you know what? I'm not too sure, but tomorrow, depending on who's in his ear, this can change very quickly.
All right, so we've maybe put the train back on the track, or at least we've started, but the challenge, of course, is keeping the train on the track. So moving forward then, TK, from a governance perspective, critical that the South African government continue to address and counteract misinformation that has been propagated not only from the president himself, but other international influential figures and even the media in many respects.
Yes, and sometimes the best way to actually do this is to look like you're working as a country. I think we've almost close to 6, if not more, months of us having this government, which is a coalition. But you do need to see wins as what makes people think otherwise. And if we do not get wins, if we don't start to see infrastructure come to the table, if we don't start to see the actual issue of crime being addressed, you almost lose, not because you're wrong in the grand narrative, but simply because people can say, listen, you know, they're lying. Look at the problems that they're having. Because many of the issues with President Trump was highlighting when he stepped down to say, okay, look, he never said, I might not be right on that. But he'd point to things such as violence. So if we don't address those types of things quickly, we're going to lose, not because we're wrong, but simply because we're not making progress on key issues that the country needs. Because the world wants to see winners, and if we don't start acting and seeing winning, it makes it very hard to counter a lot of narratives.
Both the economic freedom fighters and MK really receiving a slap from many people in the room overnight. How do you think that is going to play out domestically? Already, the EFF has issued a long, wordy 3-page statement.
Well, I think it was a bit problematic, especially I think as Mr. Steenhuisen put it. One of the key rules of such an international engagements is you and I, Jerry, might have issues at home, but you don't take those issues out overseas. One of the main reasons President Trump is such a shock to the system is there's an American rule, and it's an international rule that you never speak ill of your opposition at home because at the end of the day, you are representing them as the executive. So I think it was in a bit bad taste that the people in the room who are South African took a shot at Mr. Julius Malema and even the MK. You might not agree with him, but at the end of the day, they are South Africans. So the hope would be that President Ramaphosa, and I think even people like Mr. Steenhuisen, do get together with Mr. Julius Malema to say, listen, yeah, we might have erred on that issue, but there's certain conversations we need to start having to say, what you're saying does have international implications. How do we look like, even if we don't agree, we don't even have to like each other, but how do we look like putting across a narrative which says, listen, we are Team South Africa and there's certain things that we're working on? Because in a way, one might argue that one of the big winners of the night might have actually been Mr. Julius Malema and even the MK, because it literally, for certain segments of South Africa, they look like, ah, you see, we've always known those guys are for us. And that's not what you want. What you want at this moment in time is to have a Team South Africa, even if we don't all agree with where the country's going.
And no doubt valuable lessons learnt last night from this meeting, particularly around the importance of strategic communication and diplomacy in advancing national interests. What do you think those lessons are?
No, the key thing is you might not be able to control the message that people like President Trump send out, but I think where we have been woeful for the last 15 years is we're very poor at getting across, you know, the great message of South Africa. I think one of the things that came out last night is South Africans, we're not too au fait with international relations. And I think this is where entities like Brand South Africa, the presidency, do we almost need a whole of government reformulation on how do we get the good South African stories out there? Because look, yes, most every country has problems. I mean, there's a reason why there is no perfect country in the world. But I think where we have shot ourselves in the foot is we just have this inability to put the good stories of South Africa out there. Because many Americans would have, unlike other countries, would actually have a memory of South Africa. Yes, it goes back to President Nelson Mandela. But I don't think we've been able to build on this such that we can have mass tourism into the country and mass businesses coming through. So the hope for me would be, listen, we really do need to work on our communication. Yes, communicate, we've got problems, but it's problems every country has and that we're trying to sort out. And most importantly, let's try to sort these stories out.
That is commentator and writer Dr. TK Puer from the Wits School of Governance. TK, thank you very much.
Remember when you had to hurry up and wait, and cars could only run on fossil fuels? Well, hurry up and catch up. You don't need diesel power, you just need a second electric motor. With Volvo plug-in hybrids, you can drive electric in the city, switch to fuel for the long haul, or combine both when you want it all. So what are you waiting for? You're late for your test drive. It's safe to be brave with Volvo.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
The Finance Minister, Enoch Godongwana, delivering Budget 3.0, but did he go far enough to address the country's multi-billion rand shortfall? Well, Johan Els, Old Mutual's Group Chief Economist, has been in front of his television and joins me now with a breakdown and some analysis. Johan, I guess the obvious question to start off with, having listened to this, did we really need to do this three times? There were no real fireworks, were there?
No, there were not. But you know what, Jeremy, in fiscal issues, that's great if there are no fireworks. At least there were no bad news. But we certainly didn't need to do this three times. I'm all budgeted out for the year, but this was as good as we could have hoped.
The budget emphasizing, as we expected, fiscal consolidation. But are you satisfied with any specific measures that are in place being implemented to achieve this? And I wonder as well whether they are sufficient.
Yeah, the space where South Africa sits with weak economic growth, we absolutely need more policies and better policies and better implementation. That's somewhat outside of the minister's scope. That's for the whole of government. Better growth will fix the fiscal issues far quicker. But if we think about the budget itself, what we wanted in this third iteration of the budget, expenditure cuts, because there was such a outcry about tax increases that was not really an option, although there was some fuel levy increase, which I expected, given that petrol prices were supposed to come down in any case. So expenditure cutbacks, and mostly those extra spending that we suddenly saw appearing in February from the October 2024 medium-term budget policy statement to the February 25 budget, suddenly there was a lot of extra spending, mostly in terms of frontline services, nurses and teachers. They haven't been employed yet, so it was pretty easy to cut that back. So cutbacks there. And then talking about future tax increases penciled in, we don't know what they are, but they could be eliminated if there's better tax collection by SARS.
And there's every indication, isn't there, that that is happening?
There are lots of signals pointing that direction, that SARS has got the capacity. They actually got some more money in terms of building that capacity. We all see these numbers in the press from what extra revenue could be get from illicit tobacco sales, et cetera, et cetera. And I think there's lots of debt sitting there on SARS balance sheet that they could potentially recover. So lots of that, yes, that'll certainly help.
Johan, let me pick you up on the general fuel levy. What impact is this going to have on inflation and consumer spending? And I'm thinking particularly among lower income households.
Yeah, I don't think it's significant for lower income households. Of course, it's extra burden because the proportion of spending that they spend on transport costs are higher than for the other income groups. But overall, it's a fairly small inflation-related adjustment that we're going to see. And it's just being taken away from petrol price cuts that we would have seen, at least for this June. There would have been price cuts. Now it's going to be somewhat lower price cuts. So not significant in terms of inflation either. There are lots of other drivers of inflation. We saw the numbers this morning. That's keeping overall consumer goods inflation very low indeed. There's very little price pressures out there. The rand's busy strengthening as we speak. So that is also helping limiting inflationary impact. So inflation low and lower than what we thought a couple of months ago. And some upward path coming over the next few months towards year end, but muted upward path, very muted.
Johan, how worried are you about debt service cost? If I heard this correctly, if I read it correctly, I think 22, 23 cents of every rand of revenue. This is going to continue to impact funding for essential public services, surely?
No, absolutely. If you think about the bigger numbers, apart from what you mentioned there, more than 400 billion rand per year being spent on interest payments alone. That's equivalent to reducing the VAT rate to around 2.5% to 3% instead of 15%. That is significant. And that's why there is such an urgent need in terms of this fiscal consolidation to stabilize the debt ratio and get the debt ratio lower, because that means stabilizing the interest payment portion of the budget. That could potentially, as you rightly say, be spent on other issues, whether that's housing or education, or building the country's infrastructure, which would make the growing the economy just cheaper and more productive. So we need to do that. But the best way to get the debt and interest burdens under control, in other words, get the whole budget situation under control, is faster economic growth. So we absolutely need to do more there. We're doing a lot. Bigger private sector role in the economy, easing the structural constraints in the economy, and the cyclical side, lower inflation, lower interest rates are also helping. But the underlying uptrend in economic growth could be strengthened by faster and more policy reform.
As far as you or I are concerned, you referenced earlier about there being no change to personal income tax brackets or even medical tax credits. But is this decision really going to influence in any way disposable income and therefore change any type of consumer behavior, given that we're under so much pressure anyway?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to change a lot because you mentioned under pressure. Yes, we are under pressure, but we're somewhat better off as average consumer than last year. If you think about inflation falling rapidly, virtually every employed person in this country has got a higher salary or wage increase than inflation. So certainly that gap opening up will help consumer spending. Lower interest rates will help. But of course, absolutely, if we had some adjustment in terms of the tax brackets, that would have helped even further.
So just overall, and a final question to you, given the current fiscal framework that was outlined and moving forward, what are you now seeing as long-term prospects for our economic health and fiscal sustainability?
I think given the picture that we've talked about, better underlying growth certainly coming over time. We're doing this fiscal consolidation policy, continuing with that. So I do see the budget stabilizing. I do see lower debt ratios in the next couple of years. And that means lowering the fiscal risk. I think ratings agencies are actually behind the curve. So we can actually see positive ratings action over the next few years. I actually see within 18 to 24 months, ratings upgrades. So all of that is in line with a somewhat better path going forward. So I would summarize it by saying we've been on a significant downtrend in recent years. I think the economy, the overall situation is busy stabilizing, and I think we're heading in terms of a positive trajectory over the next few years.
Johan Els, thank you very much indeed, the Group Chief Economist at Old Mutual.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, the Endlet Africa Conference and Exhibition is ongoing in Cape Town. It brings together high-ranking government officials from across the continent, senior executives from power utilities and industry leaders to discuss opportunities, difficulties, challenges facing the sector in Africa. This event also provides a platform for manufacturers to introduce and showcase new technologies to fast-track electrification and to achieve greater energy efficiencies and energy security. It is an important event, and covering that is Andrew Maggs from Africa Mining Watch. So first of all, and welcome, the event or the conference was opened by Eskom's Group Chief Executive. Obviously, as winter starts to hit, Andrew, the utility is going to be hard-pressed to ensure adequate capacity with minimal outages. We're all holding thumbs. What was his outlook?
Well, Jeremy, if we needed a reminder that winter has arrived, Cape Town has certainly provided that confirmation with heavy rain and temperatures plummeting this week. And of course, that will put strain on the grid with greater consumption and significantly less of a contribution from renewable sources. But credit to Eskom, who've made visible progress in implementing their generation recovery plan over the past year. Albeit their streak of no load shedding for 9 months was broke back in January, and we've seen five incidents since then. Dan Marikana and his team are confident Eskom's fleet can deliver. The winter 2025 outlook is premised on unplanned outage scenarios being revised downwards, ranging from 13 to 15 gigawatts, and then no load shedding expected if unplanned losses remain below 13 gigawatts. At worst, 21 days of up to stage two load shedding if unplanned losses reach 15 gigawatts. And of course, the less load shedding there is, the greater the savings are in diesel consumption. Because of reduced diesel spend, Eskom was able to save in the region of 16 billion rand in the last reporting period. That represents a reduction of around about 50%. Dan Marikana also spoke of actions, some recently completed, others in implementation, which will ensure there's improved generation capacity. These include the return of Unit 4 at Medupi from long-term forced outage, commercial operation of Kusile 5, synchronization of Kusile 6, and ensuring successful implementation of the Coburg 2 steam generator.
I'm assuming a similar message of optimism and confidence from the electricity minister, José Nsoro Makgopa.
Jeremy, yes. First of all, the minister spoke in broad terms of the challenges facing the continent, stressing the imperative to meet the target of achieving universal energy access by 2063, especially through regional integration. Given Africa's power demand is forecast to triple by 2040, massive investment in infrastructure is required. However, as he pointed out, there's a significant funding gap, with Africa's share of global energy investment remaining below 5%. Ramaphosa strongly believes that Africa-led financing mechanisms need to be in place to reduce this ongoing reliance on external donors. And unlocking Africa's energy potential, according to the minister, needs increased investment from private sources. And it's a point that he's made previously, given Africa holds 60% of the world's best solar resources, but has installed only 1% of global solar PV capacity. This is clearly one resource that has to be exploited. Interestingly, the minister also spoke of the importance of nuclear energy in South Africa's energy mix and the potential of utilizing small modular reactors. These are scalable and can be used for other applications, such as producing green hydrogen and powering of desalination plants. And also, let me just add that Ramaphosa has emphasized the opportunity for South Africa's chair of the G20 to drive a more Africa-focused agenda on the global stage.
Andrew, much has been made of smart grids at this event and the potential to achieve gains in energy efficiency and savings, and particularly, I understand, at a household level. So give us a quick guide to the technology, and I guess it's all about whether rollout is gaining any kind of traction.
Well, Jeremy, in essence, to give you the idiot's guide, because I needed it myself. In essence, smart grids are electricity networks that use digital technologies, sensors, and software to better match the supply and demand of electricity. A smart grid will use real-time data to balance electricity flows, and this will then enhance efficiency and facilitate distributed energy resources to improve the overall electricity supply system across the grid. Now, smart grids not only provide detailed insights into energy consumption patterns, but also facilitate efficient management of resources. A smart meter, once installed in a home, then provides real-time detailed insights into consumption patterns. And this gives consumers the means to save money on their consumption. A simple example would be getting your geyser switched off during extended periods of non-use, or maybe if you're an electric vehicle owner, finding that optimum window to recharge the vehicle. Also, as one delegate pointed out yesterday in a panel discussion, with a smart grid, it's a whole lot easier to harness the power produced by renewable energy sources during optimal conditions to then store it effectively and use it during periods of high demand or when renewable sources can't generate enough power.
All right, I'm going to leave it there. Reporting from the Enlit Africa Conference, it's ongoing in Cape Town, from Africa Mining Watch, Andrew Maggs, thank you very much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, as South Africa commemorates World Biodiversity Day this week, one of the bigger threats to biodiversity comes from an unexpected source, our food system. Listen to these numbers. It drives something in the region of 80% of deforestation, contributes 70% of land-based biodiversity loss, and emits around 30% of all global greenhouse gases. And nowhere is this more evident than in agriculture, and particularly in the dairy sector. Quick bit of background here. The industry in South Africa is the fourth largest largest in agriculture, contributing something in the region of 25 billion rand to the economy and supports over 100,000 jobs. But it's also under pressure. Farmer numbers are down 60% in a decade. Milk production per cow is declining. And the threat of heat stress, disease and competition from UHT imports is rising. So one solution that is gaining traction is something called regenerative agriculture. And joining us is Vaughan Koopman, who is milk producer and a regenerative agriculture manager at Danone South Africa. Vaughan, thank you so much for talking to us today. Let's start at the beginning. Let's get a very quick definition of what type of agriculture we're talking about and how does it differ from conventional sustainable farming?
So it's, in a nutshell, it's around farmers practicing growing methods that improve the health of their land. So it's all-encompassing. It's a fairly broad definition. But if one focuses in on it, it's really around looking at cover crops, so ensuring that your land is not left bare. It's around integrating livestock into your system, realizing that it's a circular system and that livestock have a role to play. It's also around your tillage system, so adopting ploughing methods that are not highly destructive or preferentially not even ploughing one's land. It's also around minimizing chemical inputs, so be it whether it's pesticides, herbicides, as well as inorganic artificial fertilizers, using different types of crops as well, so not just monocropping the same crop year after year on the same piece of land. And then increasing the biodiversity, your natural habitats where possible. And that, you know, has a knock-on effect. Also, it includes water as well. So all things linked to water, irrigation and so forth.
So Vaughan, why is it so important now? Are we at something of a nexus point, do you think?
I think we are. We've seen so many instances locally and around the world with climate change. So increased intensity of storms, increased intensity and frequency of droughts. And we're beginning to feel it. I mean, we see it in the agricultural sector playing out and with our milk. You know, we've in the last few weeks, we've had an exceptionally wet autumn, much wetter than average. And we see how the milk production drops, you know, how the cows are under increased stress, and how that then impacts also the farmers' planting times, for example. They have to wait for the lands to dry out in order to plant their winter crops. So we're definitely seeing the impact.
So how difficult then is it to make a useful transition to this type of methodology?
Yeah. So, you know, farmers have been, let's say, adopting over the last 20 years, you know, individual practices such as minimum or no tillage. But it's definitely a challenge to adopt a more holistic approach, so the regenerative agricultural approach, because it's more holistic and multifaceted. So for a farmer to be able to, you know, adopt multiple things and take that type of approach is difficult to understand and implement, look where his opportunities are, and not know what the, let's say, the hidden costs may be, or the hidden impacts, for example, increased costs through increased pests, if he's reduced his pesticide use, for example. So it's the risk, the unknown risk that the farmer is obviously careful about, and therefore, you know, increases his hesitancy to change the ways that he's farmed over time.
Are you seeing people embracing that risk and starting to overcome it, or are you concerned about the hesitancy?
I would say it's a mixed bag. So we see farmers that are the innovators. So there are farmers out there that are the risk takers, that you believe that the regenerative agricultural approach in its broader sense is the way to go and will pay dividends in the long term. So those farmers are really, really important, you know, for us as a business to learn from, but also for their fellow peers to learn from as well. I would say the bulk are hesitant because of the risk and the unknowns, and they might be implementing pieces, but are not necessarily going wholeheartedly for the overall approach.
And Vaughan, for companies that rely heavily on milk, like yours, for instance, what's the long-term risk if there is not a shift towards this type of sourcing?
So the long-term risk is definitely increased volatility of supply. So the supply, you know, the supply being knocked heavily going down with floods or heat stress, for example, a loss of resilience in the system. So, you know, a slow attrition, loss of farmers, decreasing milk yield. So it ultimately, you know, threatens the resilience of our business, but it also threatens then food system, our ability to be able to provide food to people, healthy food, in an economical and sustainable way.
And what role does government policy have to play in this process?
So government policy is a helpful enabler. It's also a helpful way of giving a message and direction to consumers, to business, and to sectors. So, you know, through policy, through legislation, those messages can be given and provide direction for people in business to help inform decisions and the pathways that they're taking in their purchasing decisions and their business decisions.
Vaughan Koopman from Danone, thank you very much indeed. And you've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb. Your trusted source for business and investment insights.